When is it you take up residency in England?
Most of the residents went to Chicago to finish up neuropathology, neurophysiology, and neurology. I went up there to speak with Percival Bailey. He was Harvey Cushing's right-hand man for 14 years, and he wound up professor of neurological surgery at the University of Illinois. I learned that he was retiring, and so Dr. Wilkins was going to lose the relationship that we had. Automatically, all the residents went to Chicago to finish up. So I told Dr. Wilkins about this, and Dr. Eric Oldberg, O-L-D-Berg, who had taken over the chair of neurosurgery at Illinois, and I spoke with him, and he said that I was welcome to come and study, but there's no stipend associated with the residency. And I inquired, how does one live in Chicago without some income? And I went back to tell Dr. Wilkins about this, and he said, you go ahead and study at Illinois, and I'll send you the money to live on. And I told him, you know, this is un-American. Can you imagine teaching a neurosurgeon the millions of questions that were asked and all the training and so on? It's very meticulous work. And I said, train us is one matter. To support us when we leave, that's another. And I think it's un-American. Let me ring around and find a residency in neurophysiology and so on. He said, if you wish, that's fine, but I'd be happy to send you the money to study in Illinois. So I rang around and found a place at University of Texas, Kenneth Earle, neuropathologist, fine man. He said, I have a new laboratory. It's just open. We're looking for residents. And I said, sign me up. I'll be there. My income went up. I went up from $75 a month to $400 a month at the University of Texas. And as I finished my work there with Dr. Earle, I told him I'm in need of 1 year of good clinical neurology. Where would you go? And he said, there's only one place in the world to go, London. I told him that this would just almost be impossible. And he said, if you go and tell them you need help, they'll help you. I said, why wouldn't you recommend something in Houston or East Coast, West Coast, in bedside clinical neurology, and don't they have good programs? And he said, yes, they have good programs, but really the teaching and so on. The only place in the world to go to study neurology is London. I said, Dr. Earle, you're scaring me. He didn't go into great detail why. I later learned that at Queen Square in London, the first neurological hospital in the world, the hospital is divided into 36-bed wards, and each ward is dedicated to a given illness, a given disease. So there are 36 patients in bed with multiple sclerosis. There are 36 patients in bed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. There are 36 patients in bed with brain tumors. There are 36 patients in bed with spinal cord injuries. So the whole hospital, 17 wards with 36 beds per ward, dedicated to that given disease, you can get a great deal of information in a short time. Many neurologists have never seen 36 patients with MS. Now, this is terrible for the patient. There's not much privacy in the 36-bed ward. For the nurses and doctors, it's wonderful. The head nurse can survey the whole 36-bed ward in 1 minute and see if anyone needs help, if anyone's in distress, if anyone is in need of any assistance. So for the doctors and nurses, this is wonderful. For teaching, you can't beat this because you can go and examine the patients. There are the records. You can see this illness in every phase, early, late, relapsing, remitting. You can see it in every phase and gain a great deal of knowledge in a short time by that method of teaching. So I entered the hospital there at Queen Square in 1960.
What was the name of that school?
The National Hospital, Queen Square, London. It was all neurology and neurological surgery.
When you walked in there the first time, what was your impression when you came in?
I walked in that front door in that beautiful lobby, and there's a statue in white marble of Hewlings Jackson. He was probably the greatest neurologist that ever lived. As you walk through the halls there, the ghosts are there of all these greats. They've had the greatest group of neurologists, I guess, in the world. The Paris School would be second. The whole atmosphere was wonderful. I talked with the head teaching neurologist at the time, Dr. Dennis Williams. I was informed that as a foreigner, It would be very difficult to get a job at Queen Square because all British applicants took precedence. Any foreign applicant would go at the bottom of the list. And he said the only way that we could possibly do it would be to post the lists in the basements of all the hospitals where no one would read them. But he said, it's almost impossible, Coach, to get a job. My wife was an RN, and I told her that you may have to go to work because it looks rather difficult to get a residency post. They call them their registrars, here residents. I was feeling badly about this, and I ran into a little fellow named Jason Bryce, and he said, is your name Coates? And I said, yes, sir. He said, I heard you were coming. You're a neurosurgeon, aren't you? And I said, well, I finished my neurosurgical training, and I finished my neuropathology and neurophysiology, but I'm here to study neurology. He said, would you cover for me this weekend? Because I've just got to get away from here. He was a neurosurgeon at Queen Square, one of the five neurosurgeons at Queen Square. I told him, I'd be happy to cover for you, but there's a big problem. I don't have a license to practice medicine in Great Britain, and I don't have any malpractice insurance. He said, no problem. It was Friday afternoon when he approached me. We'll go down to General Medical Council, and we'll get the license and the insurance this afternoon. I said, now, Dr. Bryce, how much would that cost? And he said, don't bother. I'll pay for it. We went to the General Medical Council, and I filled out half a sheet of paper. Of course, I was with Jason Bryce, whom they knew well. Upon receiving this, the charge was $5, £2 and a few shillings, for the malpractice insurance and the licensure. So I went to work that weekend, and Saturday night around 11 o'clock, I had a phone call from Brighton. They said, we've got an 18-year-old boy who's bent a Bentley around a steel telephone pole, and he's got a rather bad head injury. We'd like to send him there at once by helicopter. I said, we're here and we're ready, and what's his name? His name is Christopher Wood. I jotted that down, and I said, we'll be looking for him. And when Christopher Wood arrived, I examined him in the outpatients department, and we got him in. He had an epidural hematoma. That's the same lesion that killed the lady skier recently, the actress. It's an urgent neurosurgical emergency.
And what is it?
Okay, it's a blood clot upon the outer covering of the brain between the skull and the dura mater, the outer covering of the brain. It's an arterial bleeding. It usually occurs from a skull fracture in the temporal region. Just a hairline fracture can tear the little artery that lies right in the bone, literally. That bleeds epidural and can kill you in a matter of a few hours. So I examined him and realized that he had a dilated fixed pupil on one side and some weakness the other side. I said, oh dear, you know, this guy's got to go to surgery. I rang up to surgery and got everything ready and ordered lab work, ordered a unit of blood to be prepared and so on. Within a half an hour, Sir Charles Simons arrived. Sir Charles Simons was the number one neurologist in London, probably number one neurologist in the world, literally. The first man to diagnose an aneurysm in a living human being, an aneurysm of the brain, that is. He arrived and he said, I came to see the Woods boy. Where is he? And I said, well, right now he's transferring him to a room near surgery. And he went there and examined the patient. Came back and I told him he's got an epidural hematoma. And he said, yes, I've got to go. And I said, yes, sir, preparing things right now. We're going right away. He no sooner left than Lord Russell Brain, editor of the journal Brain, the premier neurological journal in the world. His name, same as the journal, but coincidental. Lord Brain arrived and said, I want to see the Woods boy. And I said, Sir Charles Simons was just here, sir, and examined him. He said, yes, I wanted to examine him also. I said, tell me, now it's in the middle of the night and you two gentlemen are here. He said, you don't know who this is, Coates? And I said, no, sir. I don't know. And he said, well, his father is Sir John Wood, chairman of the Board of Governors of Queen Square. So I'm working on the boss's son. And when I saw the patient, I removed the epidural hematoma and the patient recovered. And by Monday morning was asking to go home. And I saw Dennis Williams in the hall that day. And he said, Coates, I believe if you apply for that job now, you won't have any problem. So I became registrar in neurology at Queen Square. Again, luck.
How old were you when you went into that surgery?
32.
But it wasn't your first surgery.
Oh, no, sir.
I performed many of those in Texas.
Yes, and at OU. 65 craniotomies at OU my last year there. 100 laminectomies.
So by the time you got there...
I'd been trained in neurological surgery. Had my full training and everything except the neuropathology, neurophysiology, and I was there studying practical bedside neurology. Diagnostic neurology, in other words. I wanted to learn to be able to diagnose my own cases.
So when the Woods boy recovered, did the Woods family contact you and thank you?
Yes. And, of course, Sir John Wood had to get my application for registrar in neurology, which came through right promptly.
I don't know if I call it a star, but the whole hospital knew that this Coates guy, he operated on the boss's son, didn't they?
They all knew it by Monday.
Didn't put you under any strain. I mean, you knew what you were doing.
And I knew what I was doing, and it always crosses your mind. You're working on the boss's son.
Did that change things any for you other than the fact that you got that job?
For number one, my wife didn't have to go to work. She could stay with our first son, who was just 13 months old. It provided us about $400 a month income while I was there.
Yeah.
And we lived on that in London, can you believe it?